This is edition number 1910 of The Mardler, recorded at Elsham on Friday, the 5th of April, 2024. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk, recorded here at Elsham. Today we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday, the 4th of April, 2024. My name is Caroline Allen and my fellow readers are
Lorna Wilson,
Kate Harris
and Chris Allen.
On the notice board today, please join us in wishing a warm welcome to our new listeners, Peter and Liz Hendon from Aylsham. We hope you will both enjoy listening to The Mardler. Having moved into British summertime, this week the sun will rise around 6:10 and will set at about 7:45.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes the history and restoration of the paupers' graves in Aylsham, the man who fixed Norwich's drains, a visit to Book Corner, and an interview with the musical director of Sing Your Heart Out.
But we begin with the main news items, which include the village with the most sewage spills, unhappy mental health staff, a council blunder or two, the shantymen who were too loud, and police arrests. Let's start with the main stories.
A tiny village on the Norfolk Broads has been revealed as the location of the most sewage spills in the entire county. Environment Agency figures have shown wastewater flowed from an Anglian water sewage treatment works in Beelow into the River Burr for more than 2,000 hours in 2023, the equivalent of 84 days. The spills came from storm overflows, which dump untreated sewage into rivers and the sea, usually during periods of heavy rainfall, to stop sewers from backing up and flooding. The number of sewage spills at Beelow, a picturesque village popular with boaters and paddleboarders, was almost three times the number from the previous year and was the highest in the county. The second highest number was a location on the River Ant, between Horning and Ludden Bridge, which spilled for more than 1,700 hours. The overflow here, which is near Howe Hill and in another popular area, with boaters and paddleboarders, had a total of 91 spills, lasting the equivalent of 70 days. The shocking figures emerged in a huge release of data from the Environment Agency, which said there were a total of 3.6 million hours of spills, compared to 1.75 million hours in 2022. Overall, Anglian Water, which is responsible for much of the region's sewer network, had the biggest increase in spills of all England's water companies. The data has led to calls from MPs and councillors for a national environmental emergency to be declared to help tackle the problem. Fran Waymark, leader of the Broadland Council and a member of the Broads Authority, has urged the station to be investigated and improved immediately. People should be able to enjoy our rivers without spillages polluting them and posing a risk of serious harm, said Mr. Waymark. This area of the Broads is a well-known destination for holidaymakers and locals hoping to canoe, paddleboard or just swim. But doing so could leave them with a tummy bug or far worse. Anglian Water needs to look at how it can improve this so that people feel safe. It is just not good enough. Norfolk County Councillor Rob Colwell, who is also running as a Liberal Democrat to become North West Norfolk MP, said, It is a complete scandal that filthy sewage is being pumped into our stunning Norfolk Broads and our county's rivers and waterways. There should be a national emergency declared.
Almost 6 out of 10 workers at the region's troubled mental health trust say they are still not happy with the standard of care they can provide. The worst ratio in the country. The annual NHS staff survey has shown that just 43% of Norfolk and Suffolk NHS Foundation Trust workers would be happy for a friend or loved one to receive the organisation's standard of care. And while the figure was a slight improvement on the same statistic last year, 41%, it was the lowest score of any NHS trust nationwide. The survey is conducted annually by the NHS nationally, with half of the trust's staff opting to take part in the 2023 survey, a 7% drop-off in participation from the previous year. But many of those who participated said they continue to have concerns over the care they can provide, with 70% of workers believing there are not enough staff for them to do their jobs properly. However, during a meeting of the Trust's Board of Directors, Chief People Officer Kath Byford highlighted some areas the Trust had improved on. She said, "We need to improve the way staff feel that it is a place they would recommend to work, as we are well below the national average in this area." There was a reduction in staff feeling confident, raising concerns. "It is important, though, that we recognise when things are going well. We have had net growth in the number of doctors and nurses we have recruited, which comes as a result of a lot of hard work." The survey results did show a very slight improvement in its overall morale score, though, which increased from 5.83 out of 10 to 5.87.
A blunder meant council bosses failed to send letters about a consultation which will affect thousands of people with disabilities. Parents of people with disabilities slammed Norfolk County Council after they were not sent consultation letters about controversial proposals which will affect their children. County Hall said that this was due to an administrative error. Norfolk County Council recently agreed £42 million worth of cuts and savings, including saving £1.2 million a year by reducing the minimum income guarantee, MIG, for disabled people. That is an amount of their income disabled people aged 18 to 64 can keep for everyday expenses after council-arranged home care is taken into account. So reducing it means the council can charge more for care costs. The council sent letters to disabled people themselves, even though some have appointees or deputies, often parents or other family members, who make decisions for them. Judy and Nick Taylor from Buxton have a grown-up son with Down syndrome and are on the steering group of Disability Network Norfolk Group. Mrs. Taylor said their son had been sent the letter when it should have gone to them. She said, "That should never have been sent to him. He is not going to be capable of understanding what it is all about." The consultation should have been sent to the appointees, those with deputyships and those with lasting powers of attorney. The Taylors called for the flawed consultation to be halted. Mrs. Taylor said, "If someone with severe learning disabilities was helped to complete the form by a care worker who has no idea of that person's financial situation, no understanding of the MIG, or the ramifications to the disabled person, should their views be put forward? these responses will not be fair or correct representations. A spokesman for Norfolk County Council said, following the launch of our non-residential care charging policy consultation in late February, we wrote to over 3,500 people who could be affected by the changes. It recently came to our attention that, following an administrative error, the letter was only sent to those directly affected and not to their nominated individual. While many will have already seen the proposals, we have sent out a further 800 letters to ensure everyone has a chance to put forward their views. The Council said it would not extend or restart the consultation, which runs until May the 17th.
Local councillors have been left frustrated after it was revealed plans to turn a former mental health hospital into housing had not followed the authorities' policies properly. Planning officers have recommended a scheme to turn the now defunct Milestones Hospital in Catfield into 21 houses. Milestones Hospital was shut down in 2021 after health inspectors barred it from taking new patients due to a string of safety concerns. The site should have been advertised to potential healthcare operators for 12 months before it was considered for other forms of redevelopment to ensure local facilities such as this are only lost if deemed to be unfeasible. But officers said that it was only advertised over a three-month period. Tim Harris, chairman of Catfield Parish Council, said, "The closure of the mental hospital is being sold on a false prospectus. It is frankly a joke to claim that it was adequately marketed in the middle of COVID for just 3 months when the policy is for at least a year." Other concerns include the lack of affordable housing offered by the developer Lion Properties and the effect it would have on increased traffic in the village. Matthew Taylor, NNDC councillor for Stalham, has called for a proper advertisement to be carried out before a decision is made. "I want to ensure that policy and procedures are correctly followed. The 12-month advertisement period is there for a reason," he said. "This week, the scheme will go before the Development Committee for the second time, after a decision was deferred last month. It followed locals complaining that they had been snubbed by NNDC, who failed to respond to their concerns about the project for months."
Drivers across Norfolk are warned to go slow on certain roads in the coming months as resurfacing work costs just under £12 million begins. Norfolk County Council Surface Dressing Programme, which takes place every year between April and September, will start up again on April the 8th. This year, 280 miles of Norfolk's roads will get a new seal to help prevent potholes from opening up, extend the life of the road, and provide a new skid-resistant surface to reduce the risk of accidents. The new seal consists of a thin layer of bitumen and chippings, which is laid onto the road to prevent water penetration. Norfolk County Council says people living along the routes will receive notification a day or two before the crews arrive. People will be asked not to park on the road on that day of the surface dressing work or on the following day when surplus chippings will be swept up. A 20 mile per hour speed restriction will be imposed during work and on freshly laid surface dressing for safety reasons.
A town in North Norfolk has been named as one of the top places in the UK to invest in this year. Coming in second on the list by the Sunday Times, Cromer was named as the best place for coastal living without the house price catch. The publication identified 25 locations across the country that are improving the most, looking at factors such as transport links, new shops and restaurants, as well as arts and culture offerings. The article said, once known for its faded grandeur, amusement arcades and crabs, Cromer is riding a wave of gentrification that has seen fine delis and surf shacks move in amid the chippies. People who work from home have decamped from London, lured by more affordable property prices, the sandy Blue Flag Beach, and places like the Gunton Arms, whose walls are adorned by the works by Tracy Emin and Lucian Freud. The article also mentions Cromer Art Space, the public art gallery which opened on the seafront in 2022, and the pier, which underwent significant development in 2023. The other locations that made the list's top five were Liverpool Docks, Paisley, Forest Gate and Coventry.
Victory Swim and Fitness Centre in North Walsham will benefit from new solar panels after North Norfolk District Council, NNDC, was awarded £174,725 from the government's Swimming Pool Support Fund. The fund is available to local authorities to improve the energy efficiency of public leisure centres. The energy generated at the Station Road Leisure Centre will help reduce reliance on the national grid and lower running costs for the facility, which is run by the council's leisure operator, Everyone Active. A similar £500,000 solar panel carport scheme was completed at the Reef Leisure Centre in Sheringham last year. Adam Varley, portfolio holder for Net Zero and Climate at NNDC, said, "This is fantastic news and the funding is welcome as we continue to decarbonise our estate. In bringing renewable solar energy to Victory, we will be able to generate our own power and reduce the carbon footprint of the facility."
The North Norfolk Railway has reminded walkers, cyclists and motorists to stop when the warning lights show at the Sweetbriar Lane level crossing near Sheringham Golf Course. Its train drivers have reported several users jumping the lights in recent weeks. Graham Huckins, interim general manager, said, "Crossing a railway isn't like crossing a road. The total weight of an engine and five carriages is around 250 tonnes, which means that they can take a little while to stop. So when the warning lights flash, it is vital that motorists and walkers alike stop and wait for the train to pass. We have been concerned by reports from our train drivers that pedestrians have crossed in front of their train after the crossing has been activated and red lights are showing. New signage to reinforce the safety measure has been installed ahead of the line's main season, which begins on Friday, March the 29th.
They may be known as man's best friend, but at some of Norfolk's most popular beaches, they are barred from visiting. North Norfolk District Council is currently reviewing its policies on dog restrictions in the area. Rules are in place on eight beaches and promenades in the district, including destinations such as Cromer, Sheringham and Munsley. These rules apply at certain periods or year round, and people are breaking them could face a fine up to £1,000. The council introduced its current dog restriction orders in 2018 and is currently in the process of carrying out a public consultation on extending them. The Public Space Protection Orders, PSPOs, could be extended at some of the busiest beaches and promenades in the county, but certain locations are no-go areas for dogs, including top tourist destinations like Cromer Pier, areas in Bacton, Cromer, Munsley, Overstrand, Seapalling, Sheringham, Walcott and West Runton are all under the PSPOs. Under the rules, dog walkers have to keep their pets on their leads at all times, or they are banned entirely. People can visit NNDC's website to find out more information about where and why the PSPOs are in place. The majority of the PSPOs that restrict dogs are in place over the summer months between May the 1st and September the 31st. This is due to the council believing that the presence of dogs or failure to control dogs could result in a detrimental effect on the area or put wild animals at risk. A number of these locations are known to be home to large colonies of grey seals or protected nesting birds. An area-wide order covering dog fouling is also up for review. Members of the public have until May the 1st to comment on the restrictions.
They are a Norfolk institution who have been entertaining crowds with their songs of the sea for decades. But the Sheringham Shantymen seem to have struck a note of discord in their hometown. The group has become embroiled in an extraordinary row with the pub where they have been drinking for more than 30 years after its new management told them to tone down their usual singing shenanigans in case they upset the customers. The disharmony dates back to Thursday, March the 21st, when several of the shantymen decamped to the Lobster, their regular haunt, after a rehearsal session. The group, which has toured around the world and appeared on the BBC several times, were singing some of their shanties when they were approached by staff. They asked the group to turn down the volume as there were guests, including a young family, staying. The request did not go down well, and some of the shantymen left the pub, although others stayed. One of the group posted on Facebook, "Tried the Lobster tonight for the first time since previous landlord Graham left. Wish I hadn't bothered. A good number of long-term local folks from a well-known Sheringham singing group were made to feel very unwelcome. We won't be going back." The High Street pub at the heart of the town has been the shantymen's favoured watering hole for years. The group previously filmed a video in its beer garden with a voiceover from broadcaster Stephen Fry. However, the pub has recently undergone a change of management following the departure of Graham Deans in January after 22 years. It reopened in February following a £465,000 refurbishment, which included a new bar, kitchen, guest rooms and outdoor area. It is now run by Oliver McCurlane, who also manages the nearby Crown. We asked them very politely just to quieten it down a bit, as we had all of our rooms full, one of which had a young family with a small child, he said.
A man who killed a teenager while drunk driving has been banned again after being caught more than twice over the limit. Paul Coe, 34, was stopped by police while at the wheel of an Audi A3 on Overton Way in Reefham on April the 20th last year. Norwich Magistrates Court was told a roadside breath test saw him blow 130 milligrams of alcohol, almost four times the 35 milligram legal limit, though the evidential reading taken later at the police station was 97 milligrams. Coe of Cromer Road in Hainford had denied drink driving but changed his plea to guilty at the start of his trial. The court was told he had previously been jailed for causing death by dangerous driving after he ploughed into a group of teenagers in Norwich after losing control of his car while double the limit. Lisa Jermy, 16, who was with friends outside a newsagent's shop on the corner of Magdalen Road and Waterloo Road, died as the result of the crash in October 2006. At his trial, it was revealed that he had gone through a red light and had accelerated at speeds of up to 80 miles an hour. Coe, who was aged 17 at the time, was sentenced at the Norwich Crown Court to 5 years youth detention and banned from driving for 10 years. Following her death, the family of Lisa campaigned for drivers who kill under the influence of drink or drugs to be given life sentences. Appearing in court for his latest offence, he spoke only to confirm his name, age and change of plea. His defence counsel said losing his licence would badly affect his job as a self-employed plasterer. He fully accepts the consequences of drink driving for himself and for other road users, they added. Magistrates disqualified him from driving for 2 years and ordered he pay fines and costs of £483. He was told that if he completes a drink drive awareness course, his ban will be reduced by 24 weeks.
More people were arrested as a result of being stopped and searched by police on the streets of Norfolk, new figures show. One in five of the 3,977 stops carried out by officers in the year to March 2023 led to the person searched being arrested. Home Office figures show the arrest rate was a significant increase from the previous 12 months when 5,335 stop searches resulted in 581 arrests, a success rate of fewer than 1 in 10. Stop and search is a controversial police power allowing officers to stop, question and search a person on suspicion of illegal activities. A report by His Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary and Fire and Rescue Services in 2021 found two-thirds of searches in Norfolk were done without reasonable cause, the highest in the country. However, the latest figure shows though the force was now carrying out fewer searches, it was leading to more arrests, 712 in total. The most common reason for people being stopped was suspicion of drugs, with 2,587 searches, leading to 443 arrests. There were 112 arrests for offensive weapons from 550 stop searches, and 71 arrests for going equipped from 331 stops. Stops also led to 51 arrests for stolen property, 3 for firearms and 4 for criminal damage. Campaigners have claimed stop and search unfairly discriminates against certain sections of society and ethnic backgrounds, with black people in Norfolk nearly 7 times as likely to be stopped and searched than white people last year. Akio Hart of human rights organisation Liberty said, "We all deserve to go about our lives without fear of being harassed or targeted." She added it was particularly concerning that 750 in Norfolk were on under 18s, accounting for 20% of searches on people. A Home Office spokesman said frontline officers were supported to use their powers to keep the streets safe and protect the public. "Every knife taken off our streets is a potential life saved," they said.
The organisers of Cromer Carnival have announced that the Red Arrows will be unable to perform at the 2024 event. The Royal Air Force Aerobatic Team's display is an annual highlight of the week-long celebrations as they soar above the pier. However, this year the group will not be coming to North Norfolk due to scheduling conflicts, but fortunately, an exciting alternative has been revealed. Cromer Carnival said the Red Arrows have announced their 2024 display schedule and they are performing in Canada for most of August. Unfortunately, this means they will not be attending Cromer Carnival in 2024. However, we have been successfully allocated a Spitfire and Hurricane display from the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight. In 2023, the Red Arrows display at Cromer Carnival was cancelled at the last minute due to technical difficulties. The Cromer Carnival 2024 dates are Saturday, August the 17th to Friday, August the 23rd, with the aerial display typically on Wednesday. This is the main carnival day, which also features a range of activities, an evening parade and live music.
The Overstrand Festival of Early Music takes place this week until Sunday. The North Norfolk event will feature the very first UK-based international lute competition with cash prizes. It will see 8 finalists from across the world compete in the Belfry Centre in front of 2 judges who will decide who walks away with the £1,000 top prize. The week will also feature a host of magicians from across the world, all coming together to create a series of concerts. Keith Hobday, festival director, said, "Particularly for connoisseurs of music created before Mozart composed his first symphony, we will see and hear music from the 16th, 17th and 18th centuries, ranging from instrumental works by John Dowland, Praetorius, Corelli, Geminiani and Handel to the sublime opera of Henry Purcell. Featuring the region's only professional period instrument ensemble, Norwich Baroque, plus the fabulous Bellow Ensemble, and flutes and frets from London, the instrumental playing will be of the highest level throughout the week. The week also features a new semi-staged production of the opera Dido and Aeneas at Templewood in Northreps. For more information, visit tofem.uk. That's tofem.uk.
A popular boat show is back for its 7th year. The Horning Boat Show will take place on May the 4th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. The show includes luxury motor cruisers, sailing boats and other marina items, together with charity stalls and classic cars and even an auction. All proceeds go to the Horning Community Fund, which in turn covers the cost of various activities and equipment which will benefit people living in the area. Horning Sailing Club will be making a return and hosting its Discover Sailing, which has been successful in past shows. Entry to the show is free. Free parking is being offered at Bewilderwood with a shuttle to the show for just £2. The food court offers speciality food and drinks, plus the many eateries in the village to explore. Organisers say that this event is always a great day out for the family. Visit horningboatsshow.com for details.
A much-loved Norfolk attraction is gearing up for its biggest and best season yet, with new additions for 2024. Thursford Steam Museum, located between Fakenham and Holt, is home to the world's largest collection of steam engines and organs. Visitors can also ride the gallopers, watch silent movies, and listen to the resident organist Robert Wolfe play the mighty Wurlitzer. This is a busy lineup of events planned, including 6 sold-out backstage tours of the famous Christmas Spectacular and 2 sold-out steam tours, with the latter new for 2024. Thursford Steam Gala Day is also returning for its 4th year, with tickets going on sale on April the 4th at 10 a.m. Expect more exhibitors, street food vendors, live music and a new aerobatic display. John Cushing, OBE, CEO of Thursford, said, "From the beautifully kept steam engines to the vintage fairground rides, Thursford offers something truly unique. Entry costs £9, with under 12s free, and is open from Sunday to Wednesday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m, from April the 7th to September the 4th, 2024. Visit thursford.com or call 01 328 878 477.
You are listening to edition number 1910 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday, the 5th of April, 2024. Still to come, there are items about murals, postbox toppers, and dinosaurs. And, of course, the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, just one letter to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
The organisers of the Trunch Dog Show write, "Entries are invited for the Trunch Fun Dog Show, which is being held in the village on Sunday the 26th of May from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. Organised by Trunch Village Society, the event is open to dog owners everywhere, and as the name suggests, it promises to be fun for all. The 11 classes in the show include Dog with the Most Appealing Eyes, Best Family of Dog, and Dog and Owner Lookalikes. There will also be competitions for The Fastest Recall and Dog That is the Quickest Sausage Eater. The winner of each class will be presented with a cup and rosettes awarded to fourth place. The entry fee for each class is £1. Other attractions include a variety of dog-related stalls, a barbecue and refreshments. To find out more, contact Karen and Stefan Pogonowski on 01263 720346 or email kandspognowski@btinternet.com.
There are no obituaries in the newspaper this week, so instead we will highlight a few forthcoming events.
On Sunday the 7th of April at 7:30 p.m, the Kilkennys will perform traditional Irish music at the Princess Theatre in Hunstanton. Contact 01485 532 252. Also on Sunday at 7:30 p.m, the Elvis Years will be presented at the Pavilion Theatre in Cromer. Contact 01263 512 495. On Wednesday the 10th of April at 2 p.m, the Wednesday Weavers will hold a line dancing class in the Reefham Town Hall. Contact 01603 872 102. On Friday, the 12th of April at 7:30 p.m, the UK Pink Floyd Experience is featured at the Pavilion Theatre in Cromer. Contact 01263 512 495 to book. The Vision Norfolk Cromer Audiobook Club takes place on Monday, the 15th of April from 2 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. at Cromer Library. These monthly meetings are informal, friendly, and everyone has an opportunity to give their thoughts and opinions on the audiobook of the month. The books are supplied for free on USB memory stick or CD. Contact Mark on 01603 573 0 for further details.
We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we find out about the paupers' graves of Aylsham, offer thanks to the man who fixed the sewers, consider some books, and listen to an interview with a choirmaster.
We begin with two articles which focus on the Aylsham paupers' graves. These were written during 2023 by local historian Wendy Sadler of Aylsham in Bloom. In 1847, architect William Dunthorne was commissioned to design the new Aylsham Union Workhouse. He was born in Swaffham and was a founder member of the Royal Institute of British Architects, RIBA. The building is historically important, as it is the only surviving example of Dunthorne's urban workhouses and was Norfolk's most impressive. It is now a listed building. The new workhouse did not have its own burial site. In 1847, the vicar of Aylsham, Edmund Yates, was already foreseeing problems. The old pre-1834 workhouses, such as those in Buxton and Alton, had served local parishes, and pauper burials were normally undertaken locally. With the new union now serving 46 parishes, Yates could see that his churchyard, already filling up, would be under pressure. Yates and his church wardens, William Repton and John Warnes, and the parish overseers wrote to the Board of Guardians, stating that it was impossible to bury paupers and that they would like a separate place for these burials. The workhouse opened in 1849, and matters came to a head in 1850, when the tiny coffin of nine-week-old Margaret Anne Hardingham, whose family came from Guestwick, was turned away from Aylsham churchyard, forcing the return of her body to the workhouse. Imagine the distress of her mother. Fortunately, the vicar of Guestwick agreed to bury the baby the next day. After many meetings had taken place, land was eventually set aside to the north of the workhouse and consecrated by the Bishop of Norwich, John Pelham. The first burial took place in 1857, being for Eliza Gray, aged 75 years. Burials at the workhouse cemetery continued until the early 1900s, probably until the Poor Law Union was abolished by the Act of 1929. After that, the County Council took over the building as a hospital. As part of a local history project, a team of volunteers painstakingly searched through the old workhouse records held in Norfolk Records Office. They recorded the names of all 548 people buried there in unmarked graves. They ranged in age from one-day-old twins, Florence and Martha Garford, buried in January 1883, to someone in their mid-90s. The names are now also available in the Aylsham Heritage Centre, which can be found in the grounds of St Michael's Parish Church. St Michael's Hospital closed in 2012. The land and buildings were sold to a developer who fenced off the burial ground and allowed it to become derelict. Many people in Aylsham were unhappy about this, so when the development was complete, the Town Council ensured that the site became one of Aylsham's open spaces to be preserved as part of Aylsham's social history and respected as a consecrated cemetery.
Continuing our report on the Aylsham paupers' graves, we turn to the restoration of the grave site. The Town Council teamed up with Aylsham in Bloom and other interested groups to begin the restoration project. When volunteers first visited the site, brambles and bindweed were over head height. With the help of the Aylsham Scouts, the top growth was cleared. Then, thanks to a lot of hard work from numerous other volunteers, weeding, digging and raking, the area was made ready for developing a wildlife garden. A path was laid by the town council to make the area more accessible. Aylsham Rotary provided seating for people to rest and reflect. A storyboard was constructed for the entrance, explaining the history of the site to visitors. The official opening of the garden was in March 2022. A diversity of seeds were scattered and plug plants planted thanks to a grant from the Royal Horticultural Society, RHS, two generous private donations, a contribution from Aylsham in Bloom and help from Woodgate Nursery. Under the trees is woodland planting. Grass in the open area is edged with wildflowers and dotted with patches of spring bulbs, such as daffodils and crocuses. During the first spring and summer, a plant survey was conducted by volunteers from Aylsham Wildlife Society. Over 50 wildflowers were identified. These included plants that are now rare or absent in our fields, such as corn cockle and corn chamomile. Many different grasses were seen. These are all good for bees, butterflies and other insects. With the RHS grant came advice from their regional outreach advisor, who visited Aylsham High School to explore planting suitable for the site, considering the historical use of plants. They explored uses in medicine, around the house, and also the Victorian language of flowers. Students from Aylsham High School planted ferns, foxgloves, and forget-me-nots in log piles to create stumperies. Early Greek physicians and philosophers put forward the idea of the doctrine of signatures, which states that plants resembling various parts of the body can be used to treat ailments of those body parts. An example is lesser celandine. One of its local names is pilewort. The herb was given for hemorrhoids. The knobbly tubers were thought to resemble piles. These ideas continued for centuries. Plants and herbs were the only medicines people had. In the 17th century, Nicholas Culpepper's Complete Herbal recommended field scabious wine to treat pleurisy and the seeds of aquilegia to speed the process of childbirth. Today, we tend to think that all medicines are manufactured purely in the laboratory, but plants are still very important. Present-day scientists continue to research into new and effective plant compounds. Daffodils and snowdrops are now grown to extract the alkaloid galantamine, which is used to treat Alzheimer's. Scientists found that daffodils grown under special conditions in the Welsh Black Mountains have increased levels of galantamine, so they are grown as a commercial crop. Common names of some plants tell of their historic use. Dried lady's bedstraw, which smells of freshly mown hay, was thought to act as a flea repellent and used to stuff mattresses. It was recommended for the beds of women about to give birth. It was also used as a dye plant, yellow from the flowers, red from the roots. During the Victorian period, when the pauper's gravesite was in use, there was a craze for ferns. Stumperies were created in shady places, using logs and upturned tree roots to display the plants. While it lasted, fern madness invaded all aspects of Victorian life. Ferns and fern motifs appeared everywhere, in homes, gardens, art, and literature. Their images adorned rugs, tea sets, chamber pots, garden benches, and even custard cream biscuits. So, take a closer look at a custard cream next time you eat one.
Next, we hear from Derek James as he recalls the man who improved Norwich's sewage system. This article was published in the EDP of the 27th of May, 2023. It is 125 years since a group of engineers and surveyors from across the country gathered in a marquee at New Mills Engine House on the River Wensum in Norwich to raise a toast to the work of a gentleman called Arthur Collins. He was a man of great energy and ability, and we have a lot to thank him for, not least of which was solving Norwich's long-running sewage problem. Central to his solution was the compressor station, built on the site of the old corn mill. It was a key part of the city's new sewage system and was badly needed at the time, not just to bring Norwich into the 20th century, but also to greatly improve the health of its residents. Powered by water turbines on the Wensum River, it drove pumping engines that compressed air in order to force sewage in low-lying areas to a treatment works at Trowse. In March of 1898, the mayor, town clerk, and members of the sewage committee had bravely descended through a manhole on the corner of Barn Road and Westwick Street to inspect the construction works, under the supervision of the city engineer, Arthur Collins. Later in the same year, Mr. Collins proudly invited all his fellow municipal engineers and surveyors to a meeting of their professional association in Norwich. It was an opportunity for him to show off the new compressor station and associated sewers, as well as other projects of his. These included the new public wash baths at Duke Street, and his patented street gully cleaning equipment. All the delegates gathered in a marquee at New Mills on Friday, June the 10th, 1898, and a toast was raised to Mr. Collins. So perhaps we should do the same on the anniversary of that grand meeting. Above the roar of the water passing through the turbines, speeches were made, praising both the designers and the contractors who had overcome the special challenges presented by Norwich's difficult geology. A ripple of laughter was the response to the suggestion that the city was known as a happy hunting ground for the nation's civil engineers. This was since so many had tried and failed over the previous quarter of a century to solve the serious defects experienced with the city's first sewage system, completed in 1871, and which had now finally been overcome with the new air compression system. The delegates were then led to an adjacent site, now part of the Westwick Street car park, where Mr. Collins was proud to show them another of his inventions, a refuse destructor, which was intended not only to get rid of rubbish, but also to fuel a furnace to generate power to run the air compressors when there was insufficient flow in the Wensum. Later, he showed his honoured guests another useful invention off his drawing board, Collins' patented street gully and scavenging attachment, just the thing for keeping the Norwich streets clean and tidy. As for the new mill site, it has been there since 1430, but has been taking a well-earned break since the 1970s, when the air compression system became redundant. Some timely repairs have recently been made to the roof of Mr. Collins' engine house, although the bridge is waiting some more serious work. Our city has a good track record of repurposing interesting heritage buildings, and we must all hope that, before too long, a way can be found to bring the power of the river back into good use.
This month's Book Corner celebrates the month of April. Our first book choice has been described as beguiling and amusing. The Enchanted April by Elizabeth von Arnim tells a tale of four women who escaped to an Italian castle shortly after World War I. Away from their usual life in London, they find solace in wisteria, sunshine and the beauty of San Salvador. Despite being very different from each other, they develop unexpected friendships. They take each other's journeys of self-discovery whilst finding harmony in the essence of nature. They bask in the sunlight, experience pure joy and rejuvenation. With their newfound empowerment comes rekindled love and unexpected romance. Elegy for April is the third in the Inspector Hackett crime series by Benjamin Black. As a deep fog cloaks Dublin, a young woman vanishes. When Phoebe Griffin cannot discover what has happened to her friend, she asks her father, Quirk, for help. But as Phoebe, Quirk, and Inspector Hackett speak with those who knew April, they begin to realise that there may be more behind the young woman's secrecy than they could have imagined. Why was April estranged from her powerful family? Who is the shadowy figure who seems to be watching Phoebe's flat every night? When Quirk eventually makes a disturbing discovery, they finally begin to unravel the web of love, lies and dark secrets that April has spun around herself. Loving April by Melvyn Burgess is set in the 1920s. It is a moving love story about two young people from very different backgrounds. Well-to-do Tony and his mother have moved into the village following his father's desertion. They consider the other villagers as beneath them. Neither of them is capable of cooking a meal or cleaning their own house. They are saved by April, a local girl who is deaf and unschooled. April is known for running around the village with her collection of rescued animals, unintentionally causing chaos, like on the Sunday she took her pet swan to church. Although April initially scares Tony, she confidently takes over the running of their household. She's able to cook meals and do practical tasks like starting fires. In turn, Tony's mother teaches April the basics of etiquette, such as table manners and how to dress, all things that no one else had ever bothered to do. As is inevitable, Tony and April start to fall in love. Our final book takes place in April 1982, when Argentine forces invaded the Falkland Islands. Vulcan 607 by Roland White looks at the mission impossible faced by Britain's military chiefs, the destruction of the vital landing strip at Port Stanley. The only aircraft that could possibly do the job was 3 months from being scrapped. The Avro Vulcan B-2 would need 17 separate in-flight refuelings to reach the target and give its crew the chance of returning alive. This is the dramatic account of the operation. All of these books can be borrowed from Calibre Audio Library, either on memory stick, MP3, or even listened to on the internet. You can also borrow similar audiobooks or listen to them on the internet from Norfolk County Libraries and the RNIB Library.
To finish off this edition of the magazine, we have an on-the-spot report from our peripatetic volunteer, Beverly Hopkins, where she talks to musical director Natasha Hood.
Hello, Natasha. We're here at the Lighthouse in Sheringham. We've just had a session. This is the group that I belong to. Could you tell us something about your role with SYHO and obviously what SYHO means?
So SYHO stands for Sing Your Heart Out, S-Y-H-O. And this is a Norfolk-based, a Norfolk-wide singing charity, Singing for Wellbeing, that's now in its 20th year. So we're celebrating SYHO's 20th birthday this year. I've been involved for the last 6.5 years or so, first as a tutor and currently as the musical director. So it feels very special to be a part of this small charity that I really believe in. I think it brings so much hope and joy and upliftment to people. Come out of a singing session that was high energy. I'm still a little bit buzzy from it.
And I was going to say I thoroughly enjoyed it. And actually, everyone seems to be joyful and enjoying what we're doing. It's a real group.
Exactly. And that's part of what I love about it. So today I think we had about 40 people, and that seems to be consistent in the Sheringham group. I'll talk a bit more about that in a moment, because there are five groups across all of Norfolk. Anyone is welcome. It's a very inclusive group. No auditions, anything like that. We sing by ear, so it's not sheet music.
And any age?
Any age, any ability, and yes, no experience of singing needed. It's just a case of turning up.
I've noticed that one of the participants uses a larger booklet, if you
That's right.
So it's inclusive yes. if a partially sighted person would like to join.
Exactly. So we have, each group has two or three copies of the, so we work from a songbook that is compiled of songs from all around the world, different traditions, folk traditions, pop songs. So some are in foreign languages, so all sorts, contemporary as well, from secular tradition too. And yes, so everyone receives a songbook as they arrive, and there are two or three large print copies to make it hopefully as inclusive of everybody as possible.
And is it free to join?
So it's free to join, although donations are very welcome, because as I say, we are a charity, and so all of our funding, yes, we have to fundraise somewhere, so we apply for grants and get funding, but also each group has a little box which we collect donations from each time. So it's fine to not put anything into the pot, and if you can, then people do. So Sheringham is actually the youngest group, been going about 6 years. There's Norwich, Great Yarmouth, King's Lynn and Hingham. It was originally in Attleborough, but now Hingham, which brings to mind each year we have what we call the Big Sing, where all of the five groups come together. So it's an annual joyous gathering.
I'm looking forward to
of
that.
Of singing and harmony and joy. And so and all of the tutors are there, the trustees. We've got a fabulous, very committed, hard-working, big-spirited group of trustees and volunteers, again, without whom the organisation would not be thriving. So it's mainly volunteer roles, apart from the tutors get paid, and then so that's the big cost probably.
And do we have to hire this hall?
And the venue, yes, the venue. Exactly. So each session costs over £200 to run, so hence our need for funding and the donations, yeah.
I found it by word of mouth. How would anybody else find out about it?
Word of mouth is a significant number of people come to us because they've heard of it via somebody already here. Yeah, we do it. We advertise as best we can. So there's our website. You can find out leaflets about the place in GP or medical practices, sort of mental health charities or organisations also are aware of us. And so word gets passed on that way too.
Because it is mainly about well-being, isn't it?
Exactly.
Singing our heart out.
Exactly. The emphasis is on well-being. So with very specifically not a performance group, it is about turning up on that day and having a really good time.
And you don't have to have any ability, as you said.
No.
I can't sing, I don't think, but I enjoy singing that
exactly.
I do here.
Exactly. And I think the beauty of singing in a big group like this is that we can each bring our individual voice, but also feel part of something like the bigger whole. And I think that's
true.
That's a big part of the uplifting experience that singing together is. And we very, a big part of the work that we do, it's not just sing-along songs, it's we teach songs in harmony. So we would sing from between 2, 3 and 4 harmony parts or rounds. I think that adds a huge amount.
And I've noticed as well in the booklet that some of the songs that we sing have actually been written by yourselves as tutors.
Some, yes, I have to say I can't take any credit for that personally. That's not my strength. So, but some of the arrangements, that's the term that would be used for. So we take a song that's out there or known and then but put the harmony parts in.
Okay.
So yes, Chrissy Parsons-West, the musical director for many years with Sci-Ho, 16 years or so, she did a lot of the arranging. For some of the songs, yes. So there's a mix.
But not written by yourselves?
Most of them not, though one or two are. There are a couple of lovely songs in that book. One's called The Wellbeing Song and the other's Singing's Got Inside of Me. And both of those two have been created by Sing Your Heart Out tutors based on feedback that people have given from the groups. So
brilliant.
So they're very personal and particular to Sci-Ho, which is a lovely thing.
We all enjoy it, we really do. Thank you very much for telling us about Sci-Ho, and let's hope we encourage more fun.
Yeah, my pleasure. All are welcome. So please look us up on the Sing Your Heart Out website, which is www.sciho.org or singyourheartout.org. Yeah,
brilliant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks to Wendy Sadler of Aylsham in Bloom, the editors of the EDP, and to Calibre Audio for their permission to use their material.
In our penultimate section of news items, we have 3 reports from Sheringham, 2 reports from Cromer, and some chips at sea.
Plans have been revealed to build a new retirement community in a Norfolk seaside town named one of the best places to live in the UK. Retirement housing company McCarthy Stone has presented plans to build 41 one- and two-bedroom apartments at the Esplanade in Sheringham. The apartments would all be designed to meet the needs of local older people who may be struggling to downsize, providing them with the opportunity to move into more suitable homes while staying close to family and friends. McCarthy Stone says typical people would move from within 5-mile radius of its new developments, meaning it would free up homes in Sheringham for families and first-time buyers to help ease North Norfolk's housing crisis. Older people moving into the apartments are expected to release at least 82 family-sized and starter homes back onto the local market. This is in line with the North Norfolk District Council, the NNDC, local plan, which states there is a need for housing of this kind for older people in the district, as North Norfolk is the local authority area with the oldest population in the country. The developer has also said the local economy would benefit, with people living in the homes proposed for the site being expected to spend a combined £308,000 each a year at local businesses. People living in the properties are also expected to have a reduced risk of health challenges, such as dementia, slips and falls. According to the developer, this could save social care services and the NHS £3,500 per year per person, with the entire development potentially saving £1,801,000 per year. A community consultation has begun to gather early feedback on the plans, which will be used to shape the developer's planning application submission to the NNDC. The virtual consultation is open at mccarthystoneconsultation.co.uk/theesplanade until April the 19th, 2024.
the art group behind a beautiful mammoth mural at a Norfolk seaside town has launched a new initiative to help local artists turn their passion into a career. Sheringham Art has unveiled a 95-foot-long hand-painted mural of a scene from the last ice age at the town's East Promenade. The mural is painted on 127 recycled scaffolding boards and took 4 years to complete. The project was inspired by archaeological discoveries at the North Norfolk coast, including the oldest human footprints found outside of Africa and the world's most complete step mammoth skeleton. The footprints, dated at between 850 and 950,000 years old, were found in Haysborough, and the mammoth skeleton was uncovered in West Runton. Sheringham Art has also announced it will be supporting local artists with a series of planned projects which aim to get the public to participate in transforming dull spaces in the town. Through these high-profile public art projects, the group hopes to generate publicity, driving sales of a local artist's work, which will be displayed in a new online gallery. Artists are invited to apply to join the virtual gallery, and successful applicants will be given expert time to develop a professional digital profile with written copy, mock-ups, and high-resolution photography of their work. Sheringham Art will create limited print editions on their behalf, mitigating the start-up costs facing artists wanting to go it alone. The group hopes to position artists' work as souvenir alternatives for tourists, inviting them to take home a piece of the community that directly supports the artist and future public projects. Colin Seal, a founding member of Sheringham Art, said, "The recently unveiled mammoth mural is the first in a series of planned artworks by the volunteer group. Important historical discoveries have been made along our coast, and we wanted to do something to celebrate our deep history," Mr. Seal said. Last week's North Norfolk news story on the Mammoth Project incorrectly said it was in Cromer. We apologise for any confusion caused.
Duncan Baker, MP, has visited a Norfolk high school to find out how funding helped to launch its participation in the Duke of Edinburgh's award. Sheringham High School joined the Duke of Edinburgh's award in 2022. The North Norfolk MP has visited the school to witness firsthand the impact that the scheme has had on pupils. The school was able to start the award with funding from the Duke of Edinburgh's organisation, which allowed them to purchase the necessary equipment. Rebecca Shepherd, the school's Duke of Edinburgh's award manager, said, "Being able to offer our young people the chance to do the award has allowed us to discover what our students engage in outside of the classroom. I'm grateful to the Duke of Edinburgh's award for the funding which has made this possible in opening the door to these opportunities." Now in its second year, the award programme has been received positively by the pupils. Currently, 33 young individuals are working towards their bronze award, while 25 are aiming for silver. Dawn Hollidge, senior deputy head teacher, said, "The scheme helps students to develop skills of resourcefulness and resilience, which are transferable to their academic experiences and lead to increased engagement across the curriculum. Mr. Baker shared his own Duke of Edinburgh's award experiences and had lots of advice for those partway through awards. He said, "I'm a huge advocate of the Duke of Edinburgh's award. I loved every minute of doing it and have very fond memories that have stayed with me. I think the school are doing a fantastic job of giving these young people a really unique experience, and I wish all schools could make this available." The Duke of Edinburgh's award requires young people aged 14 to 24 to select activities that involve improving physical skills, volunteering, and completing a demanding expedition.
The owner of a seafront cafe has reassured customers he will remain open despite uncertainty over the future of the town's cherished RNLI Lifeboat Museum downstairs. The Rocket House Cafe on the first floor of Cromer's Rocket House building at the end of the Esplanade is still open for business despite the RNLI looking set to close the Henry Blogg Museum on the ground floor later this year. The Lifeboat Charity has said a chronic damp problem is causing costly damage to its collection. It has served a break notice to North Norfolk District Council, which owns a building, to terminate its lease in July. However, the Rocket House cafe owner, Robbie Kirtley, says his cafe upstairs has not been hit with the same damp issues and remains open. "We've been promised by the council that the cafe won't be affected by any future repair works which takes place at the Rocket House. We won't be closed at any stage." Mr. Kirtley, who opened the cafe with panoramic views overlooking Cromer Pier and the North Sea in 2006, said, "I have no damp issues at all anywhere in the cafe. The council is doing as much as it can to get the issue fixed downstairs. I've always had a great relationship with the RNLI and its volunteers, and together we've made this building a success. Hopefully that will continue for many years to come. This building, in my eyes, is as iconic in Cromer as the pier. It's not going anywhere. It's too much of an asset, with the lift offering disabled access down to the promenade and pier. People have supported us throughout thick and thin, and we cannot wait for the upcoming season. Easter and the summer are our busiest periods, but even outside those times, the great thing about this place is that it's a local caff which people enjoy all year round."
A knitted Easter topper that was taken from a Cromer postbox has returned. Two local people who keep their identities a secret spent many hours creating an adorable seasonal scene featuring chicks, bunnies, a basket and bunting. They put the topper on the postbox in Overstrand Road ahead of the Easter weekend. But sometime between 8pm and 11pm on Good Friday, it went missing. The news was posted on the Love Cromer Facebook page, and it was met with anger and disappointment from locals. Disheartened by the disappearance, one of the makers said, "I really expect it to be put back on. Generally, people do the right thing, don't they?" The topper has now been returned in a spring-like fashion and was spotted on its original postbox following its weekend long stint of absence.
The spring market is back at a Norfolk estate over the Easter holidays, and it will feature more than 50 local stalls. The two-day event will take place in the Lady Elizabeth Wing at Holcombe Hall from 10am to 4pm over the weekend of April 6th and 7th, with free entry. There will be a tempting range of food and drink to fill up and feast on, including homemade jams, chutneys, cheeses, fresh bread, cakes, and a selection of beers, ciders and spirits. There will also be gifts and crafts from some of East Anglia's most talented makers. Outside, there will be street food from the duck truck, the big cheese, the Kraft Burger Company, Bucket List, Chim Chim, Randy's Seafood, Sinbin, Solar Scoop and Express Coffee. Well-behaved dogs on leads are welcome in the Lady Elizabeth Wing courtyard and indoor bar area. There is free entry with parking at £6 a day. See the full Easter programme at holcombe.co.uk.
A new Norfolk food business will prove that hash browns are not just for breakfast by offering them loaded with a range of tasty toppings. Friends Max Swan, 30, Will Durham, 31, and Guy Gillingwater, 33, who all went to Aylsham High School, have joined forces to create Hash Papa. Their skills marry together perfectly, with Mr. Swan, a chef, Mr. Durham, with a background in project management and promotion, and Mr. Gillingwater in logistics. Everything is made from scratch, and they will be announcing a location in Norwich soon. Ahead of this, they are hosting a pop-up in their new trailer at Aylsham Marketplace from 5 p.m. on Saturday, April the 13th. The loaded hash browns on offer will include truffle macaroni cheese with crispy bacon and buffalo fried chicken with blue cheese. Mr. Durham said, "I go to festivals a lot with my job. I was with my girlfriend and all she wanted was some hash browns and we couldn't find any. I then mentioned it to Max and he started making them." Mr. Swan added, "Working with my best friends is something I have always dreamt of doing."
An upcoming event on the Norfolk Broads will include a trip on a historic wherry and a fish and chips supper. Wherry Yacht Charter is a charity that operates 5 of the remaining 8 wherries on the North Norfolk Broads. Olive, Norada, White Moth, Hathor and Ardia. The 2024 season begins in May with the options to charter one of the Edwardian sailing boats or book a spot on a scheduled trip. On Wednesday, May the 15th from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m, a return trip is running from the wherry base at Barton House in Wroxham to the Norfolk Broads Yacht Club, Wroxham Broad. Passengers will travel on either Olive, Norada or White Moth and a fish and chip supper will be served in the clubhouse. There is a choice of either a battered fish fillet or scampi, both served with hand-cut chips, mushy peas and tartar sauce, or vegetarian option. Also included in the price is a glass of wine, beer or soft drink with your meal. Tickets cost £60 per person. Book and see all the 2024 scheduled trips and information on chartering a boat at wherryyachtcharter.org.
In our last few articles, we hear about the Howe Hill Trust, a dinosaur park, a 1940s railway weekend, and a swagger stick linked to the Great Escape.
Observing kingfishers, dissecting owl pellets, and hammering thatching reed into place. These activities are all part of school residential stays, which have happened at an educational site overlooking the Broads since the 1960s. A typical school residential stay at Howe Hill also includes dike dipping to find the creatures lurking in the Broads waterways, learning about bygone life in a riverside cottage, orienteering, a nature trail, plus arts, crafts and fun games with a nature theme. After Norfolk County Council discontinued operations in 1983, the charity Howe Hill Trust took over the educational centre and is planning to celebrate its 40th anniversary this summer. The Trust continually improves and adapts its offerings. These improvements, which included additional ensuite bathrooms during a COVID-related closure, aim at future-proofing the centre and broadening its appeal across age groups. The enhanced facility allows the Trust not only to accommodate more school children, but also increasingly cater to adult groups during the off-school period. The adult course, which the centre offers, includes varied activities such as sailing, church visits, bird and butterfly tours, and theme-based food evenings. And it is these adult courses that provide vital extra income for the charity to support its core schools work. Simon Partridge, director of Howe Hill Trust, said, "Visits to Howe Hill have a big impact on students, learning about nature at first hand in a magical setting, as well as the adventure of staying in the house. We constantly get adult visitors who always speak fondly of the time they came to Howe Hill as a child. It makes memories which last a lifetime." A recent visit by Year 5 students from the Pilgrim Federation in North Norfolk, comprising schools in Blakeney, Kelling, Hindringham and Walsingham, saw 22 youngsters enjoy the fun activities. Howe Hill Trust Chairman Richard Batson said, "We are looking forward to our next 40 years with positivity."
Make the most of warmer evenings by heading to a late night event at the UK's largest dinosaur-themed adventure park this summer. These special events are taking place at Roar in Lenwade in 2024, with pre-booking essential at roar.co.uk, and Roar is spelt R-O-A-R-R. There are late night openings on Saturday, May the 25th and Saturday, August the 3rd, from 6pm till 10pm. Price from £9.95 per person. Annual pass holders and children under 90 centimetres tall go free. Expect all the usual Jurassic fun across the 85-acre park, but with a late night twist. Explore the attractions, including Dippy's Theatre with live shows and two rides, the Swingosaurus and Raptor Contraptor. Discover the Valley of Dinosaurs, Lost World Amazing, Dippy's Raceway, Jurassic Putt, Crazy Golf, Dippy's Splash Zone and the Predator High Ropes, plus the outdoor and indoor play areas. In order not to disturb the resident bats, the rides will close at 8:30pm and Discoveryland shuts at 9pm. Or how about Dinos at Night on Saturday, June the 29th, also 6 till 10pm. Price is from £10.95 per person, with a 20% discount for annual pass holders, and children under 90 centimetres go free. Bring all the family to Dinos at Night and enjoy Roar's attraction, plus some special additions, including educational tours with the resident dinosaur hunter. Evening antics will include game stalls, live music from Enigma and local street food traders. The Dereham Theatre Sister Act cast will also entertain the crowd. Or there's Dinos in the Dark on Saturday, August the 24th, also 6 till 10pm and priced £10.95 per person, with 20% discount for annual pass holders and children under 90 centimetres go free. From trekking through the Valley of Dinosaurs under the stars to handling nocturnal creepy crawlies in the secret animal garden, visitors attending Dinos in the Dark are in for a wild night. Local band Big Summer Blowout will be performing at the event. Alongside Roar's attractions, there will also be educational tours, local street traders, and the chance to interact with local clubs and societies.
A railway station is hosting a 1940s themed weekend with a steam engine, vintage vehicles, craft stalls and music. The annual two-day event is set to return on April the 6th and April the 7th at Whitwell and Reefham Railway. Running for more than a decade, the Vintage Weekend promises 1940s fun and nostalgia, allowing the community to step back in time at the station. The free entry weekend is open for anyone to attend, and visitors are encouraged to dress in their finest vintage attire to jive, jitterbug, and swing away to 1940s music all weekend. Both inside and outside the station, various stalls and exhibits will be fronted by local businesses, crafters, artisans and charities, celebrating all things 1940s. Outside the station, up to 20 different vintage and military vehicles will be on display, including a vintage tractor. A spokesman for Whitwell and Reefham Railway Station said, "Last year was one of the best events we've thrown. It's such a good vibe with everyone in their vintage gear. It's really nice to see everyone dressed up. We try to incorporate everything people would like at the events, and it's nice to see people learning from history." The station will be running its steam train all weekend for a pay-on-the-day trip where visitors can hop on for a jolly down the track. Food and refreshments will be available alongside a children's play area, and parking is free. The station's licensed bar and restaurant will be open to the public between 10 a.m. and 6 p.m. All funds from the event, which runs from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m, go towards restoration projects and the maintenance of steam trains led by the station's Heritage Railway Charity.
A unique memento of a hero from the Great Escape will go to auction after being found by a plumber at the back of an airing cupboard. The Gresham School Swagger Stick had once belonged to Marcel Zielsen, one of the masterminds behind the famous Second World War Nazi prison break. Sitting forgotten for 20 years, the find coincided with the escape's 80th anniversary last week. The 70 centimetre long stick has a lacquered Malacca cane body and a nickel pommel which bears the badge of Gresham School Officers Training Corps, OTC. The name Zielsen is scratched into the stick and the words Gresham and Holt are both visible. Matt Croson of Hanson's Auctioneers said, "It belonged to him when he attended Gresham School OTC as a teenager from 1930 to 1933. His swagger stick, a short crop usually carried by a uniformed person as a symbol of authority, is a memento of a man who will never be forgotten." Mr. Zielsen, who is believed to have been the inspiration for the Scrounger character in the 1963 film, played an integral role in the escape as he could speak fluent German. Mr. Croson said, "The estimate may appear modest, but the memories it's likely to unleash will be monumental." Had the piece been connected to Zielsen's wartime service and the Great Escape, it would be worth much more. But this is a pre-war piece from his teenage years in a school officer's training corps. Nevertheless, thanks to the impact of the Great Escape, the find may surprise us all under the hammer. The swagger stick will be auctioned on May the 15th at Hanson's Auctioneers, Medals and Militaria Auction, with a guide price of £100 to £150. The Great Escape. Marcel Zielsen also passed away at the age of 81 in 1999, was born to a German father and Irish mother, and spent his early life in Bradford. In 1943, he was sent to Stalag Luft 3, a prisoner of war camp that held Allied Air Force personnel after his Hurricane plane was shot down in North Africa. An expert at document forgery and outwitting Nazi guards, he was last in a queue of 200 men waiting to escape the three tunnels out of the camp. His life was more likely saved after the plot was foiled and he managed to flee back to his barracks. Of the 76 who escaped, most were caught within days, and 50 of the recaptured men were executed on Hitler's orders. The Nazis had believed the camp was escape-proof, but on the night of March the 24th, 1944, in a great act of defiance, they were proven wrong.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker to listen to the talking newspaper skill.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please, remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Wilson. Editing and producing this issue were Chris and Lorna Wilson. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health, and we look forward to joining you again in a week's time. But for now, it's
cheerio!